He's not an anarchist. He's not even a thoroughgoing anti-statist. He's really in favor of a government that's there, but that is shaped in ways to also allow market systems and prices, the free play of prices, to flourish.
Welcome to Acton Line, a product of the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. I'm Eric Cohn, executive producer. In 1980, the economist Milton Friedman released a 10-part documentary series on PBS called Free to Choose. In each of the episodes, Friedman presented a short documentary film in which he served as tour guide, explaining his perspective on a host of social and political issues, the power of the market, the real history of the Great Depression, inflation, consumer protection, worker protection, and more. Following each short documentary, Friedman would debate the film and its ideas with an array of guests. The show was a hit, and it possessed a staying power long past the time that it aired. I can say that for sure because it was a huge influence on me, and I only saw it for the first time in 2009. A winner of the Nobel Prize for Economics and one of the leading public intellectuals of his time, Milton Friedman and his ideas have influenced debates on economics and public policy deeply. Friedman's gravitas is now captured in a new biography by Jennifer Burns, Associate Professor of History at Stanford, entitled Milton Friedman, The Last Conservative. Today, I talk with Burns about Friedman's life, his ideas, the important women in his life and his work, and the legacy he left as both an economist and a public intellectual. You can find additional resources in the show notes for this episode, as well as find previous episodes of Acton Line on our website at acton.org/actonline. And if you like this program, you can help us reach even more listeners by sharing it with a friend and leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We welcome your comments as well. Acton Line is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Jennifer Burns is Associate Professor of History at Stanford University and a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. She's the author of the book Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. She has written for the New York Times, the Financial Times, Bloomberg, and Dissent, and has discussed her work on The Daily Show, The Colbert Report, and elsewhere. Her most recent book is Milton Friedman, The Last Conservative, which we'll be discussing today. Jennifer Burns, welcome to Acton Line.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So tell me what led you to write this book, Milton Friedman, The Last Conservative. What brought you to writing a biography about Milton Friedman?
Well, it really grows out of my first book, which was an intellectual biography of Ayn Rand, the libertarian novelist and philosopher, and really focused primarily on her connection to American conservatives, the American political right. And so felt like with that book, I had done a good job of thinking about this kind of grassroots figure who was not part of the establishment, who people found on their own and kind of constructed their meanings about her ideas, and then, you know, took these fiction ideas and transformed them into politics. So that was a really interesting story. And I was kind of wondering, what is the other half of the story? What does the establishment view look like in kind of more of the top-down view? And so I was trying to put together a more comprehensive history of conservatism, and I kind of bumped into the Chicago School, and I realized pretty quickly this is another version of the Rand story, but again, from the vantage point of credentialed university-level economists. And I was like, well, let's read up on the Chicago School. Let's read up on Milton Friedman. And I really quickly found there wasn't like a go-to text on Friedman. And so I started playing around with the idea of writing about him. And pretty soon I was launched on this project because I feel like biography and intellectual biography is a really valuable way to bring ideas that are maybe dense or complicated or just not immediately intrinsically compelling to kind of bring them to life. And that's what I ended up trying to do with Friedman and the History of Economics.
So tell me, who is Milton Friedman? Where does he come from? And kind of bring us up to the point where he, what gets him into the field of economics?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, Friedman had his was mostly known as an economist. But when I talk about in the book, I'm not just looking at Friedman, the economist. I'm also looking at Friedman, the policymaker, Friedman, the political figure, and Friedman, the economist. And these kind of three Friedmans kind of blend throughout the book and come to the fore at different parts. And so to start in the beginning, Friedman is the child of Jewish immigrants to the United States in the late 19th century, early 20th century. What's unusual about his family, though, is while most of these immigrants stayed in New York or Chicago and were kind of immersed in a very urban Jewish ethnic experience, his family went to a small town in New Jersey called Rahway. And so he grew up in small town America. He had this very sort of idyllic boyhood in the small town. His parents were, you know, his dad was a jobber, so he was sort of a wholesaler, and his mom ran a retail store. And so, you know, they were okay. They were economically stable, but they were by no means wealthy. But he grew up in this town where they had a small Jewish community and he had access to public education. And I would say the big tragedy of his youth that I talk about is his father dies when he's in his senior year in high school. He's nonetheless very accomplished academically and ends up with a scholarship to Rutgers. And he is at Rutgers when the Great Depression hits. And so that's really what shifts his interests. Prior to that, he's thinking of majoring in mathematics. He's thinking of being an actuary, someone who's just kind of crunching numbers. And when he starts to see this mass unemployment, the economy grinding to a halt, he gets a set of bigger questions, like, why is this happening? How can we be so prosperous and so poor at the same time? And so that's really when the turn to economics comes, because he thinks it will provide better answer to these questions. And that's kind of his state of mind when he heads to the University of Chicago, where he'll arrive in 1932, which is the, you know, the worst low point of the Great Depression, when bank failures are spreading, unemployment close to 25%. And so again, that really proves fundamental that the experience of the Great Depression and the belief that economics could potentially explain it and provide a way to prevent it from happening again.
Who was influential on him? Who was influential in kind of forming his early ideas and economic theory?
So when he gets to Chicago, he kind of meets the first of a series of very influential professors. One is Frank Knight, who is at that time really a titan in the field of economics. And he's known for sort of two things. One is he's very much opposed to the trend in economics towards institutionalism. So Frank Knight is more what we would call it today a neoclassical economist. And secondly, Knight is really interested in questions of risk and uncertainty. And he uses these questions to kind of develop a defense and an analysis of capitalism. So as he's opposed to the institutionalist method in economics, he's also opposed to the institutionalist program of social reform. And so Knight stakes out a position as a liberal. You know, calls himself an old-fashioned liberal. And by the time Friedman arrives, Knight has become convinced that liberalism is endangered by species of illiberalism left and right, be it communism, socialism, fascism. So he sees himself as kind of defender of a dying tradition. And that viewpoint proves really influential for Friedman. He's kind of immersed in Knight's world. And, you know, the group of students that he's in, I talk about them in the book. I call them the Room 7 Gang because they took over a storeroom in the basement of the social sciences building, and they just hung out there all the time. And they basically talked about Frank Knight. They were Frank Knight's acolytes. So that was a really important figure at Chicago. He's also influenced to some degree by Jacob Viner, who's someone who looks into price theory. And then another key figure who's part of this Room 7 gang is Henry Simons. And Simons is a really interesting economist because he publishes in 1936 a positive program for laissez-faire. And he really argues these ideas of liberalism can be used to craft social reform. In other words, social reform doesn't always have to mean socialism or regulating the market or redistributing. At the same time, Simons has some of the 19th century left in him. So he calls for nationalization of certain industries we might call natural monopolies. So like railroads or telegraphs. But after that, there should be no regulation. So Simons is this kind of strange mix to the modern eye of he's in favor of high taxation, he's in favor of limited nationalization, and then he's in favor of total deregulation. And so this is a sort of heady stew of mixes. But I think what really comes out of it for Friedman is, one, I'm part of a larger philosophical tradition that's in trouble. This tradition of individual liberty, limited government is being threatened on all sides. It needs defenders. And secondly, that I can use this tradition to think about policy and politics in really interesting ways. In other words, I don't just have to be saying no to everybody's great ideas. I can come up with great ideas of my own. So those orientations really carry through with him throughout his life.
Talk to me about a monetary history of the United States, how he becomes identified with this way of thinking about monetary policy. And then secondarily, this would, I guess, be a good point to bring up too. He writes this book in conjunction with Anna Schwartz. Talk to me about like that partnership, as well as, you know, we see later on in his career, it's Milton and his wife Rose who are writing books together. So you see this Milton working in collaboration and in collaboration with women specifically.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's see. I have to stay with Chicago for a minute here, because the other piece of the puzzle that he gets at Chicago from Knight, from Simons, from Viner, from Lloyd Mintz, his other professor in monetary history and theory, is an understanding and an interpretation of the Great Depression that really links it to problems in the banking system. And Friedman's professors were very involved in what was called the Chicago Plan of banking reform. Simons was kind of the spearhead of this. And it's actually pretty much what was adopted in the 1935 Banking Act. So they're calling, before modern bank regulation, they're calling for modern bank regulation. And they're really seeing there's something in the financial system that's caused this depression. The reason that's so important is towards the end of the 30s, when the ideas of John Maynard Keynes become popular in the United States in academic circles, Friedman already has an explanation of what caused the Great Depression. He has kind of an understanding. And so he doesn't, like many other economists, felt like they didn't have a good grip on the Great Depression, and that's what they got from Keynes. And Friedman is really different in that respect. So time goes on, you know, he finishes in Chicago, he has a few government jobs, and then he has the great good fortune of getting hired back to Chicago. And here's where a really interesting thing happens. He's been hired essentially as a mathematical economist and a statistician. And he decides he wants to teach a course on money and banking. And at the same time, he begins a research project at the National Bureau of Economic Research on the history of money. And this is where he comes together with Anna Schwartz. Now, the person who suggests they work in partnership is Arthur Burns. And Burns is another really big figure in Friedman's life. They were they met as student and professor at Rutgers. And so Burns is an influence on him, I would say more personally and in the broadest sense intellectually, in that he shows Friedman a path to becoming an economist, and they're very close personally. But their economics is different. So at any rate, Friedman is joined in this project with Anna Schwartz. And at the beginning, so Anna Schwartz is has been a Columbia graduate student, but she had worked on a 3-volume history of the British economy with 2 other economists. So she really knows her economic history kind of inside and out. So as they come together, Friedman, he sort of has this hunch, right, as I mentioned, that something to do with money and banking is at the root of the Great Depression, but he doesn't really have the evidence to talk it through. And he has been educated in Chicago with the quantity theory of money, which is an older idea, kind of a perennial idea, but it's rearticulated in the early 19th century by Irving Fisher. So he has this idea that the quantity theory of money is an important thing to be considering. And so he basically partners up with Schwartz, and what they decide to do is a historical analysis of money in the United States. And they are literally constructing the data and measuring and putting together the amount of money in the United States at different historical points in time. It's really Schwartz who does the lion's share of the research, and Friedman is kind of directing overall. But as I talk about in the book, Schwartz makes many different contributions, among them convincing him that this shouldn't just be a bunch of tables and charts, that there should be a story to this. And so together they end up writing this 150-year narrative history of the United States. And what really catches people's attention is the chapter on the Great Depression. in which they go back to the Great Depression. They analyze the quantity of circulating money, and they show that it declined by a third during the Great Depression. So that's a powerful argument for the monetary forces. But then they go even further and they dissect the Federal Reserve's decision-making and policies at that time. And they essentially argue the Fed made a lot of mistakes, most importantly, by not really doing much, that this was a liquidity crisis. The Federal Reserve could have infused liquidity into the system, and it did not. And so that has become sort of the playbook of financial crisis ever since. I mean, it's had a huge impact, and it really is something that we can credit with avoiding a depression of the scope and scale that they lived through. So it's, you know, just an incredible piece of work that is published finally in 1963, but they start working together in 1948. So this is really both of their life's work.
And then talk about his, you know, a little more about his partnership with Schwartz, and you know, the you know, I've heard from other interviews that you've done this kind of interesting intersection of, you know, him working with women in these professional ways at a time when that was surprising.
Yeah, and this was really interesting. So he and Schwartz, she was in New York, he was in Chicago. They would meet maybe once a year, but the phone calls are too expensive, so letters go back and forth. So he really could see in a lot of detail how they would argue over different points, how they would go back for more data. You can see Schwartz kind of suggesting, let's make this more into a narrative. And then about, you know, midway through the project, she, you know, sends him this letter. It says, gee, you know, I'd really like to get my doctorate from Columbia. Do you think I could use part of this project? And Friedman's very surprised. He's like, you don't have your doctorate already? Like, sure, of course you can use part of this. And then there kind of unfolds this story where she goes to her professors at Columbia and they say, no, this isn't adequate. And then it kind of dies down, and then it comes back. The book is about to be published, and she comes back to Friedman and says, you know, I still haven't gotten my doctorate. And he's really shocked. He's like, what? And he sort of figures out that they, how badly they're treating her, basically. And they're saying, you can't have a co-authored project as a dissertation. Well, in fact, Friedman's dissertation at Columbia is co-authored. So it is really, it's just sort of rank sexism. So he manages to push through and get her a doctorate. What was so interesting to me about this episode, of course, unto itself, it's interesting, but actually Schwartz is not the only woman with whom Friedman worked very closely. So he also worked very closely with a group of women on the theory of the consumption function, which is a more technical work of economics, but also very important for his stature in the field. And a lot of that was with started with a paper his wife wrote with her closest friend. And then these conversations kind of continued and eventually turned into that book. And then Rose Friedman was, an author on Free to Choose, and also a co-author, or sort of, you know, an unattributed co-author on Capitalism and Freedom. She's listed eventually as written with the assistance of Rose Friedman. So what I really discovered is that, you know, Friedman benefited enormously from these collaborations with women. And what is really interesting is that so few men of his time were able to really think about or notice the intellect that these women had. And so, for instance, Schwartz, you know, was very treated very badly by her peers. The other women who he collaborated with, you know, never ended up in the same, with the same type of stature and respect Friedman had. So I ended up believing that he had an ability to just kind of perceive what these women could offer as intellectuals, rather than just assuming they had nothing to offer as women. And I end up thinking that's really a secret to his success. So if you took all the work he did and you extracted away the women who assisted him, you may think you'd still have a very good economist. I don't think you'd have a great economist, because I think these women helped him sort of get to another level, both in his perceptions and in his productivity.
How does Milton Friedman become the public intellectual? Because, I mean, we're at the point where I encounter Milton Friedman, well after these events happened, but was, for me, the rise of YouTube and the appearance his appearances with Phil Donahue on Donahue's show in like 1979, 1980, and then the Free to Choose series, which comes out in 1980, but he and Bob Chittister begin work on that in the late 1970s. I love that story too, as an example of their original concept of him going around and giving speeches and this be the fodder for what would become the series, realized it wasn't quite working the way they wanted, and they changed it into that short documentary and debate. But again, to the point of that, like the debates that happen at the end of those episodes, you see how good he is as a public intellectual, engaging with other people and doing it in such a cheery way. What brings him from being, you know, the way we think about economists with the green eye shade and crunching numbers to being this incredibly compelling public personality?
Yeah, I mean, he always had the ability to speak very fluidly, easily, you know, summarize complicated ideas, and always really enjoyed arguments. So I think that was kind of just part of who he was. It's interesting. I discovered the book that really created him into a public figure was A Monetary History of the United States. And this is very serious, you know, 700-page academic work. But because it offered a new conception of the Great Depression, it caught everyone's attention. It was written up in all the major newspapers. It really changed perceptions of him. And it also caught the eye of the presidential candidate, Barry Goldwater. And so Barry Goldwater began relying on Friedman for advice, and the two became very linked in the media. So Goldwater's ultimately unsuccessful in running for the president, but, you know, Friedman really, his success comes out of that moment. He becomes a Newsweek columnist shortly after, and then in the 1970s, as you're describing, he kind of makes a move onto TV. And so, but that Newsweek column is really important because it sets him up as a sort of economic perspective, economic authority, from the more conservative perspective for, you know, millions of Americans, just, you know, month in and month out, he's appearing in those pages against, often counterposed to Paul Samuelson, who provided a more liberal view. So that's part of it. And then as he begins to, you know, wind down his professional economic research in the early 1970s, he has more room to go into the public sphere. And that association with Barry Goldwater continues. He has an association with Richard Nixon, and then a fairly close relationship with Ronald Reagan. So over time, Friedman comes to represent a kind of political trend and a political identity as much as an economic one.
So Free to Choose, probably where regular people, if they you know, aren't into reading 700-page books on monetary history of the United States, probably where they encountered him. What did you find in your research about how that project came to be and the impact that that project had on people? Because I can tell you, you know, again, obviously I'm a giant nerd in the fact that I do this kind of work, but, you know, I've rewatched it several times over the years. And, you know, of course, the documentary parts of it are centered around the time that they're recorded. But to me, it remains this incredibly compelling work. And I love the casting of it in the book sense, too, a personal statement.
Yeah.
So you get this sense of how he sees the world, and then not just entirely within the confines of economics, but economic implications on public policy, and then just kind of the macro point of his belief in the importance of human freedom.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to the Chicago days. You know, there is that belief in individual freedom that really comes out of his connection with Frank Knight and his sharing of Frank Knight's ideas. And then the idea that you can take the economic point of view, or the sort of free market point of view, and use that to craft policy and to suggest new ways of doing things. Again, I think he gets that, the hint of that from Simons, but he really makes that his own. So, you know, the idea that you could use the price mechanism, supply and demand, to structure things like national parks, or use it to replace regulation, or use it to use different incentives around anti-poverty policy, you know, such as a guaranteed income or things like that. That's really part of what I think makes his ideas so compelling and so fresh. Now, in terms of how that series came to be, one of the triggers for it was that John Kenneth Galbraith, a more liberal economist, had a television series. And I believe it was Rose who kind of watched this television series and was like, wait a second, like, Milton, you should do one from the other side. And so I think, you know, what Friedman really, for much of his career, was an outsider and was kind of on the edges, both of his discipline and of politics. And by the time you get to the late 70s, the 1980s, those views are becoming more mainstream, in part because there's new challenges, and in part because Freeman's able to kind of get the airtime and basically say, and that, you know, they as they present to PBS, they argue, you know, you've presented fulsomely on the kind of liberal perspective on economics, which is also very well represented in major national publications. What's the other view here? And so he's able to kind of make an argument that the other view should be aired. And then it coincides that series with the Reagan campaign. So I think the two of them work symbiotically, and you viewers can look at Free to Choose and say, this is some part of what a Reagan administration would look like. There's some resemblance here. And I think that's very powerful.
Talk to me about his... One of the things that stands out about Friedman to me is you mentioned that he can talk fluidly, he can summarize complex ideas, he liked to debate. And I know people that is true of who don't come off nearly as warm and with quite the same disposition as you see in those public appearances. Did you see that same kind of personality, you know, shine through in his correspondence? Because I always appreciated him bringing that enthusiasm for his ideas and positive enthusiasm for them into the public square, to the point where I wish more people who believed in those kinds of ideas would represent themselves in similar ways.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that is a function of where he ends up in that stage in his career. And I think it's deliberately adopted. I have to say, as I show in the book, they're definitely sharp elbows earlier in his career, for sure. So he's not always the happy warrior, or his words are not always well received. And in fact, he's very intimidating to his fellow economists because they sort of view him as dangerous. Like, he's quick, he's fast, he's extremely knowledgeable. And, you know, there are times when he'll really call people out and really embarrass them. So I think there's a different side in the debate within his field, and then he kind of switches into a more general positive register for those broader audiences. But it also may be that at this stage in his career, he's just feeling more generous in general, and that comes through in his affect as well.
As you dug into his history, you know, for someone who lived so much of his life in public, what was there anything that you found about Friedman that was really surprising to you that you weren't expecting to encounter?
Well, one of the surprising things was this, the way he relied so heavily on collaborators who were women. I hadn't really noticed that. I mean, vaguely, I noticed he had a co-author here and there, but that really surprised me. So that was one thing, that he had this really rich series of relationships and correspondence. The other that surprised me was that his first kind of step into the limelight came from this very rigorous academic study. It really came from his intellectual findings. I had thought it originally, before I really did the research, it was Capitalism and Freedom, which was his more popular book that really encapsulated a kind of 60s zeitgeist of certain kind of libertarian conservatism. That book really was not successful until after A Monetary History. And it was because of the success of A Monetary History that people became interested in capitalism and freedom. So that was surprising to me, just in terms of thinking about how does an intellectual affect the public sphere. I wouldn't have thought, you know, it's by publishing a 700-page history that took 12 years to write. You know, I wouldn't have thought that would be the impact. So in some ways, that's heartening. And I think it's because he did target that critical episode of the Great Depression, which in the 60s is not that long ago. You know, it's still very real for people. So to have a new perspective on that is really something.
Tell me a little bit more about, you know, you mentioned his relationships with political leaders. You know, what to him was the dynamic of that? I've heard an interview with him where he talked about, like, you know, he wouldn't want to be the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors because, you know, you either have to, at the end of the day, go along with what the political leader wants to do, or you can resign. And I remember him saying that, you know, he enjoyed the freedom to, quote, be irresponsible. How did he view those relationships with politicians, knowing the limitations and the environment in which politicians have to operate?
Yeah, I mean, he was actually offered to be on the CEA during the Eisenhower administration, and he declined it. And I think partly it was his life stage, and partly was that wanting to be independent and not wanting to have to toe a line. So I think he was very persistent with Goldwater. He was persistent in reaching out to him, even when Goldwater wasn't interested. Nixon, the administration, is a really interesting case study because he thought Nixon was quite intelligent, but he didn't trust Nixon, and he was very disappointed by many of Nixon's policies. So, but he didn't give up. He didn't denounce Nixon. So, for instance, the wage and price controls that were instituted to control inflation, he was very much opposed, and he did criticize them quite publicly, and he felt free to do so. But he stayed really connected to the Nixon administration, primarily through his relationship with George Shultz, where he was still trying to back-channel Treasury Department policy, still trying to influence the Federal Reserve, although he had a large breach with Arthur Burns, which I cover in some detail in the book. So he didn't pull away despite his disappointments. Now, when it came to Reagan, he was a little more circumspect. He really believed in Reagan as both a person and a politician. And so, for instance, didn't express too much concern about Reagan's deficits and even said, oh, well, these won't be so bad, and continued to kind of believe this would be a very fiscally conservative administration as it continued. And then he gave Reagan enormous credit for supporting Paul Volcker in the fight against inflation.
In terms of public policy impacts he had, we'll go back in time a little bit for this one because it's the one I've got to ask about. Tell me about his relationship to the creation of income tax withholding.
Oh, yeah. This is an interesting one. So he, when he finished finished up his studies, although he hadn't quite filed his dissertation, was the outbreak of World War II, and lots of economists went into work for the government. And at that point, he took a position at the Treasury Department. So here's what's interesting. There's a lot of, it's kind of a lot of misunderstandings about his work in the Treasury Department. First of all, he really viewed this as supporting the war effort. So he saw, no matter what, he's supporting the fight against the Nazis. So he's thinking about economics within this broader framework that's taking priority. Secondly, the Treasury Department was actually quite conservative within the New Deal universe. And so Treasury was really a holdout against the Keynesian trend in economics. And so there were lots of these New Deal agencies that were popping up, and the Treasury Department would be kind of putting the brakes on all of them. So, for instance, there was a big debate on how to manage wartime inflation, and the New Deal, the more recent agency, the Office of Price Administration, wanted to have price controls on everything. And to Friedman, this was like a terrible idea. You would create this elaborate bureaucracy. It would be intervening in all sorts of prices. It wouldn't really work. And so he came to the position that it would be better to use taxation to remove some of this money from circulation. And again, he's thinking a wartime economy where you don't actually have, the economy can't expand to meet new demand because the government is taking so much of its output. And so you would have all this money circulating with not a lot of consumer goods. So he decides taxation is an easier way to kind of pull this off. This doesn't mean he's in general an advocate of high taxation or that in general he's a Keynesian economist, but this is what he's thinking in the war context, where if the Treasury Department loses its battle, what will rule the day will be price controls that might never be removed. So at any rate, he is tasked with thinking about how to make the tax system more efficient. And we really have to think about this because prior to World War II, taxation is not a mass phenomenon. It is, you know, only restricted to the very highest incomes. And in order to pay for the war and to spread the burden, basically a system of mass taxation is instituted. And so, Friedman is one of the people who's tasked with figuring out, can we do something akin to we remove the money, we get the money from the employer rather than from the employee. So withholding, which we're all comfortable with today, we all know today, but it seemed like a wild idea. Like Congress really didn't think it would work. So basically Friedman just kind of went around. He was sent out by Treasury to investigate how other places had done this, to research other systems, and then to talk to companies about how they did payroll to see if it could work. So basically he's a technician who describes how this policy can work, give the Treasury Department confidence it can do this, although it's not until he's moved on to another job that it actually passes. So, I mean, this is something that Rose gave him a lot of grief for, you know, said you should never have done it, you know, all of this. But if he hadn't have done it, somebody else would have been hired in his place. And it's also, you know, one thing I traced in the book is that, you know, we think of him he can be remembered, especially that YouTube Friedman, as just anti-government through and through. But if you look at his life in the round, during the Great Depression, he sees a very important role for the federal government in relief spending. During World War II, he sees a very important role for the government in supporting the war effort. And so throughout his life, he's not an anarchist. He's not even a thoroughgoing anti-statist. He's really in favor of a government that's there, but that is shaped in ways to also allow market systems and prices, the free play of prices, to flourish.
This would be a good place to ask about one of the key points of his legacy before I ask you to summarize his legacy in general, which is his promotion of school choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that is interesting. I think he probably first saw that idea in John Stuart Mill. There's like a line or two in On Liberty where he discusses that. And I know Friedman read that and annotated it in his graduate years. And so he starts this proposal. This is very much a Friedmanite move. Like, let's take prices. Let's take the incentives that arise around market exchange and let's use them to craft the policy. So instead of having a federally funded, let's say out of taxation, schools or state funded, I guess this is earlier, state funding is often through states. Instead of state funding, what if the state funding goes instead to the individual purveyor in the marketplace who makes choices and is in a competitive system of schools that they may choose or they may not choose? So basically, that's a very standard Friedman trick, which is let's take supply and demand, let's take incentives, and let's use them to actually craft policy itself and to supplant a state program, although in this case, not supplant state funding. And so what happens in his case is he writes this up in the early 1950s, and it really collides almost immediately with desegregation in the South. And so it then gets taken up by a number of Southern, basically Southern opponents of racial integration, who say this will be a great way to avoid integrating our schools. We'll just disperse these funds to citizens who can then freely choose what type of school they want. And so what's interesting is that, Friedman pauses only a very little bit when he sees that segregationists are taking up this policy idea. He's not a segregationist himself. He's somewhat in favor of integration, but he's suspicious of any state mandates. And he decides in the end that school choice is a good enough idea that, he's going to stay with it no matter who its proponents are. So that's a real first boost to this policy. It's not the only one. And in fact, it's taken up in some African-American communities to improve their own schooling. And, school choice has gone through many twists and turns, but I think overall, the policy has succeeded in what Friedman thought was important, which is putting more competition into the educational system. And towards the end of his life, he began to worry a bit about globalization. You see the beginnings of a worry about globalization. And specifically, he's worried about what's going to happen to the low-skilled American worker in the face of globalization. And so he comes back to education as really the only solution. And he and Rose will leave a good deal of their money to a school choice foundation because they believe that's really the best way to address inequality and to address, the challenges that are going to be coming in a more globalized world.
So what is Milton Friedman's legacy today? I mean, we've seen, we can identify him with the political right through the politicians that you had referenced earlier, but we certainly see the political right in an interesting state right now, kind of evolutions from one that Milton Friedman, I imagine, obviously felt comfortable in his time, but you wonder about how he would feel about it today. What is Milton Friedman's legacy now?
So, what's interesting is that Friedman was in partnership with and support of the conservative movement and the Republican Party through much of his life. But that's not the only place we see his legacy. In fact, by the 1990s, this kind of set of ideas that I described, I think of it as the kind of toolkit that when you're thinking about policy, when you're thinking about, social goods or what should come next, instead of just automatically assuming a state-run centralized program is a good idea, we now think about, well, are there some way we can use market forces? Are there some way we can harness incentives? And that's really the Friedmanite move. And that has become foundational, I would say, or has been for a while into both political parties and kind of the mainstream of policy. And so when you think about the legacy of, you know, the response to coronavirus, the idea of just quickly dispersing the money out and letting people figure out how to make their choices around that's in many ways the legacy of Friedman. Even more broadly, if we think about central banking, now Friedman had very specific ideas about how he thought central banks should be run in terms of monetary aggregates and a monetary growth rule. And those specific rules haven't been taken up. They don't map onto our institutional frameworks and arrangements. But his broader idea of saying monetary policy is very important, stable prices are very important, the Federal Reserve is very important. We need to really center this in our consideration of economic prosperity. And then his just basic idea of steady growth, that has been really foundational to modern central banking. And we see versions of it in whether it's an interest rate rule or an inflation target. These are all what Friedman stressed was important, which was rules rather than discretion, setting up really clear metrics and frameworks for the running of policy rather than just the discretion of policymakers, which of course sounds like who would want just the discretion of policymakers? But at the time when he was writing, that really was what carried the day. And so there are these ways in which Friedman's legacy is somewhat invisible to us today because it seems so common sense. It seems so evident. It seems just the way things always have been. What I'm really trying to do in this book is take you back to the time when Friedman was the weird guy and the ideas were the crazy ones and show how he kind of fought them and brought them into the center.
For our final question, I want to ask you one I know you've gotten a whole lot, which is this man who I believe would identify himself as a libertarian in the title of the book, Milton Friedman, the Last Conservative. Why the choice to call him the one, a conservative, and two, specifically the last conservative?
Yeah, I mean, I've thought a lot about it. And I think in some ways, you know, his influence goes far beyond conservatism. But in his lifetime, first of all, as an economist, he did conserve these older ideas, whether it was the quantity theory of money or the tradition of empirical research, and against some very strong opposition. And I think readers will be surprised to see like how low his reputation was for many, many decades in the 20th century among fellow economists. And then because of his political alliances, which really were with individuals and activists and politicians that called themselves conservative, and they meant the kind of distinctive American conservatism that arose in the 20th century, which was blended social conservatism, strong anti-communism, and this kind of libertarian economics emphasis on the free market and the benefits of capitalism that Friedman really embodies. And so the fact that Friedman is in the mix is really what makes American conservatism distinctive, because it hybridizes things that in other countries are called neoliberal or considered more radical. And so Friedman helped kind of bring all of these together because of his ideas and his person and his willingness to be in partnership in a coalition. And so I think the question, the last, just gestures to the changes in 21st century conservatism, you know, that we are experiencing, and where Friedman has become, again, attacked from the right and the left, which I think shows how dominant his ideas were and that they represent one consensus position that comes to us out of the 20th century. And, you know, of course, there will be people calling themselves conservatives. I don't know that we'll have quite the same blend that we had, because it was really forged in the Cold War. It was forged out of World War II, and we're just in a very different space. So I think my title is really an invitation to think about all of this and to use history to kind of think about how we got to where we are and where might we want to go next.
Yeah, and the Samuel Huntington tradition that conservatism and radicalism are the only ideologies that are entirely contextual does invite you to ask the question of conservative of what, and the comfortability, I would imagine, somebody like Milton Friedman. Well, I don't believe he really used the term conservative to describe himself. You know, it is conservative of the liberal Enlightenment revolution that this country was based on. So it's it does it it made me look at the book and just from the title alone and start thinking about it just from that concept. So I appreciate what it's doing there.
Yeah, I mean, he is a liberal, and we are in a moment where liberalism is being challenged, in some ways challenged by conservatism, in some ways challenged by illiberalism. But it's a hard word to use in the American context because we tend to collapse it into the New Deal or into the Democratic Party. But I do think Friedman goes beyond all that and speaks to much larger questions.
Jennifer Burns is Associate Professor of History at Stanford University, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. She is the author of the book Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. She has written for the New York Times, the Financial Times, Bloomberg, and Dissent, and has discussed her work on The Daily Show, The Colbert Report, and elsewhere. Her most recent book is Milton Friedman, The Last Conservative, which we've been discussing today. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us today on Act in Line.
Thanks for having me.
As always, thank you for listening. Our team loves putting this podcast together for you. It's encouraging to hear from our listeners. Feedback is incredibly important to us because it lets us know what you'd like to hear more of, including the kinds of topics you're interested in most. If you have comments, feedback, or ideas for a show topic or interesting guest, you can email our team at producer@acton.org. Until next week, for Act in Line, I'm Eric Combs.